Welcome to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On September 27th, 2020, Azerbaijani military forces attacked the region called Nagorno-Karabakh. It's an autonomous region in Azerbaijan populated by a vast majority of Armenians. Armenians call this region Artsakh. The subsequent war lasted 2 months, and Azerbaijan re-seized much of the territory they had lost in an earlier war that ended in 1994. In the ceasefire, the region of Nagorno-Karabakh was linked to Armenia through a narrow strip called the Lachin Corridor. And in December of 2022, Azerbaijan closed this corridor, used by Armenia to supply Armenians living in Artsakh. This has created worsening humanitarian conditions, including violence along the corridor and cutting off supplies to Armenians living in the Nagorno-Karabakh. On today's show, we will explore the legal, political, and military implications of the closing of this corridor. Our panel today is Steve Swordlow. He is Associate Professor of the Practice of Human Rights in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Southern California, notably a colleague of mine at the University of Southern California. He's the author of Uzbekistan's Religious and Political Prisoners and Uzbekistan's Ethnic Minorities, Out of Sight but Not Out of Mind, but has also researched extensively in the Caucasus region. And Richard Girigosian, founding director of the Regional Studies Center, or RSC, an independent think tank located in Yerevan, Armenia. And he joins us from Yerevan. He's also visiting professor at the College of Europe's Natalin campus and senior expert at Yerevan State University's Center for European Studies. He's the author of the book chapter, Small States and Large Costs of Regional Fracture, The Case of Armenia. Thank you both very much for joining us. And Richard, the Lachin Corridor was this essential area where Armenia could supply Armenians living in Azerbaijan in this Nagorno-Karabakh region, and it gets closed in December. Why was it closed, and what has this meant on the ground?
Well, that's a very good question. In terms of the significance of this Lachin Corridor, it's important to note that this has been historically the only lifeline, the only connection from Armenia proper to reach Nagorno-Karabakh with a majority Armenian population historically. What we see more recently, however, is yet another serious escalation. In this context of escalation, since the war of 2020, the move by Azerbaijan against the corridor and preventing access in and out is really no surprise and nothing new. In other words, what we see is a steady and consistent ramping up of pressure on Armenia, as the war of 2020 for Azerbaijan was dangerously incomplete. They failed to actually win complete control over the contested enclave. Therefore, what we see is yet another escalation. But there is a clarification. This is not technically a blockade, because we do have the ability of the International Committee of the Red Cross and Russian peacekeepers to deliver critically needed medicines and other emergency supplies. It's more of a Game of Thrones medieval siege, where the Azerbaijanis are trying to enforce control in order to inspect what's going in and out. Nevertheless, we're on the verge of a serious humanitarian crisis, as we're now in over 87 days of consecutive blockage.
And just as a clarification, you mentioned the Russian peacekeepers. What is the role of Russia post-ceasefire in this region?
Well, I would say that the war of 2020 ended with two significant unilateral moves by Russia. First, a Russian-crafted ceasefire agreement was imposed by Russia in order to end fighting. Second, after years of Russian weakness and absence militarily, Russia finally got what it wanted most. the unilateral deployment of 2,000 Russian peacekeepers into the region. It's something they've long pursued, but were prevented in the past from obtaining. Therefore, the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh depend on their daily security and safety on the presence of the Russian peacekeepers. This is also why it's extremely significant that Azerbaijan's move against Nagorno-Karabakh and against the corridor represent an open defiance of Russia on the ground.
And we'll explore that in some greater detail, including what this means for Russia's position in the region, certainly in light of the invasion of Ukraine. But I want to bring Steve Swerdlow into the conversation. This is a complicated question on the basis of international law, correct? And I know that there was a case brought before the International Court of Justice addressing this question. So I guess first, could you talk about the case that was brought before the ICJ and what some of the findings have been?
Well, that's right. We can start with the so-called World Court, the International Court of Justice, which is a really remarkable judicial precedent that we now have. It's a provisional order on February 22nd in a 13-2 decision. The International Court of Justice conclusively stated that Azerbaijan is under an obligation to lift the blockade. That it's required, I should be more clear, required to provide unfettered access through the corridor. It did not rule on one of the claims that Armenia had invoked, which was that Azerbaijan was cutting off natural gas and power. The Azerbaijani response to that argument was that gas and power outages are just part and parcel, or they're par for the course. They happen frequently, and they weren't sort of done on purpose. That wasn't ruled on. But what is really significant about this decision is that we now have this precedent. The judicial record is now clear that there is a blockade. But I agree with Richard that this is not, we can invoke, and I think it's very important that we start thinking about it in terms of parallels, like the siege of Sarajevo, and even go back to Leningrad in World War II. This is absolutely a crisis. But we do have the court saying that this is a humanitarian crisis, that Azerbaijan is under a categorical obligation to stop this. And I think it also really dispenses with the total nonsense claim that has been put forward since this began on December 12th, that the so-called eco-activists, the environmental activists that Azerbaijan claimed were acting on their own accord. The court basically said that it's absolutely clear that Azerbaijan, you have authority, you have effective control over these so-called protesters, and you can move them out of the way, and you can resume natural transportation and movement along this corridor. So that was important because, it ended that really silly discussion that Azerbaijan had led, that this was a spontaneous protest or that it had something to do with legitimate claims of civil society. And we know now, and the court is saying that that is not the case.
And by the way, the eco-protester element to this, they were making claims about removal of mines, correct?
That's right. They said that this corridor would be used to bring in landmines, and sort of framing that in an environmental discussion is, for lack of a better word, it's very rich when Azerbaijan's conduct 3 years ago, as Richard was just noting, we had such a brutal conflict. We had the use of white phosphorus, cluster munitions, so serious damage disproportionately conducted by the Azerbaijani side during the playing out of that conflict. So these claims of environmental damage, I think, were, again, sort of really, really quite loaded.
And so ultimately, Richard, the big broad question here, sort of our next area I want to address here, is how much this is an international conflict versus an internal conflict. From a legal perspective, of course, Nagorno-Karabakh is a part of Azerbaijan. But historically, Armenia has claimed this, my understanding, on two grounds. One is a sort of a historic ground that this region has always been a part of Armenia, and then also very much on an ethnic, human rights grounds. These are Armenians, and that Armenia has a duty, a responsibility to protect Armenian human rights. So ultimately, is this Armenia's primary motivation in wanting to even maintain the corridor, be able to provide supplies to the region?
Well, if we step back, and I must confess, I'm not a law professor, but I am a student of international law. And we have an added element from an international legal perspective. Essentially, the conflict has long been a contradiction, a clash between two competing principles of international law, self-determination versus territorial integrity. How to square that circle has never been fully reached. But what we do see is, in many ways, Nagorno-Karabakh is an aberration. This conflict first erupted before independence of either Armenia or Azerbaijan. It was during the Gorbachev period. And we do know that the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh followed the letter of the law of the then Soviet constitution to break away, to secede from Azerbaijan, which means in reality, Nagorno-Karabakh was never part of today's independent Azerbaijan. Nevertheless, even Armenia does not recognize the independence of Nagorno-Karabakh. And Armenia lately has been much less of a responsible, let's say, actor, empowered or obligated to defend Nagorno-Karabakh. Rather, Nagorno-Karabakh has increasingly been looking to Russia and much less to Armenia, while the Armenian government is distancing itself from the conflict and instead promoting direct negotiations between the democratically elected officials of Nagorno-Karabakh with the Azerbaijani authorities. This, however, may be the most realistic way forward. What we also see, however, is Azerbaijan continues to adhere to maximalist demands, even ignoring or not giving credit to Armenia for key concessions and compromises. This maximalist position makes it even more difficult to forge post-war stability going forward.
I want to delve into the politics in Armenia a little bit, and then we'll come back and talk some of the human rights issues. You mentioned Armenia has been, I think the framing that you use is less responsible vis-a-vis Nagorno-Karabakh. How much of that was driven by the political change, the so-called Velvet Revolution, and the way in which the subsequent governments saw this region as a political issue that was a winning issue? The phrasing I've seen in a lot of places is Artsakh is ours, which certainly, you know, would be a different relationship than supporting whether it's the rights of Armenians living in Azerbaijan or an independent Nagorno-Karabakh. Is this being driven quite a bit by domestic Armenian politics?
It's difficult to say whether it's being driven, but it is driving domestic politics. But if we step back, we've had a rare victory of nonviolent people power in Armenia back in 2018. Much of the change of government was against corruption and resisting the authoritarianism of the former governments. This is very important because it was less geopolitical and less nationalist in its implementation. The change of government also brought to power a new leader of Armenia, current Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan, who has no connection to Nagorno-Karabakh, whereas the last two presidents came to power from Nagorno-Karabakh and came to power because of Nagorno-Karabakh. So in this way, the Pashinyan government that has been governing Armenia since 2018 has engaged in a policy pursuing what I call burden sharing, where Nagorno-Karabakh shares the burden and responsibility to negotiate a political mechanism to deal with the Azerbaijanis. And this is perhaps Armenia cutting its losses, but a more realistic adaptation to a painful new post-war reality.
Interesting. And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the ongoing crisis, humanitarian crisis, security crisis in the Nagorno-Karabakh or Artsakh region. And our guests today are Richard Garagosian of the Regional Studies Center in Yerevan, Armenia, and Steve Swerdlow of the University of Southern California. And Steve, I want to turn to you about some of the humanitarian issues that the blockade raises within the region. I've heard stories about populations at risk, populations being threatened. First of all, what are some of the humanitarian conditions on the ground in the region, and what are some of the possibilities if there isn't some sort of a reaction to ensure the corridor remains open?
Well, you know, as Richard mentioned at the start, it's only the Russian troops and the International Committee for the Red Cross that have access to be able to deliver humanitarian aid to the roughly 120,000 ethnic Armenians living in the territory. And we've seen, you know, classic problems associated with a blockade. We have store shelves that are bare, lack of heating and electricity. That means that education has been halted for nearly 30,000 children, a rationing of basic goods. And there's been a really, again, this is one of the aspects of this conflict that is so 2023, is that on social media, as we've seen in other aspects of this conflict, the Azerbaijani government-sponsored accounts are trying to assert that there are no problems, there's no blockade. In fact, hey, look at these shelves of these restaurants. People are eating well, they're celebrating, there's no problems. But the reality, of course, we know from credible sources, including the human rights ombudsman of Artsakh, of Nagorno-Karabakh, which is doing documentation work, and other NGOs outside, and also Amnesty International put out some statements, that we have really serious humanitarian concerns, the inability to perform medical procedures. There was at least one death because of a procedure that was not able to be carried out since December 12th. And so we have some serious mounting obligations, mounting on the burden of Azerbaijan to address these things. And of course, that's why I think the court ruled as quickly as it did. And, you know, one other reason, you going back to your earlier question, Doug, about Richard so expertly laid it out, it's territorial integrity versus self-determination. And we ask ourselves, why is Armenia, as another state, able to raise these claims? Well, another reason that Armenia is empowered, is enabled in the international legal framework to do this, is that these obligations not to impose blockades, not to violate human rights standards, they are what we call erga omnes. That's what the International Court of Justice ruled. These are obligations that affect all states, that go towards all states. So even a so-called non-injured party, Armenia, is empowered before the International Court of Justice to raise a case. And they had previously raised another case about the overall policy of Armenophobia conducted by Azerbaijani state officials going way back, but certainly since 2020. And that case is also ongoing and deals with a longstanding policy, which we've seen all throughout Azerbaijani society, top down from the government, which is, you know, erecting museums that grotesquely depict Armenian soldiers as barbarians, the curriculum in schools that advance and assert an idea of Armenians as not just guests on their territory, but completely, as I said, barbarians or uncultured, the classic enemy. And that kind of vilification is something that the court has also been looking at. So I think all these things come together. So whether or not, however, that circle is squared, as Richard again said, we have human rights law. And human rights law says unambiguously that Azerbaijan cannot violate the right to life. It can't engage in these sorts of humanitarian cutoff on its own territory. So that Azerbaijan must accede to those obligations under human rights law.
This is wonderfully complicated. Part of what you raised here is obligations states have to respect human rights, you know, broadly. You know, human rights instruments suggest this. I mean, states have signed, ratified these instruments. So irrespective of whether or not Nagorno-Karabakh is legally recognized as a part of Azerbaijan, which of course it is internationally, Azerbaijan has these obligations. You seem to suggest that Armenia's ability to bring this case, and you say it's an uninjured party, because again, officially, Nagorno-Karabakh Artsakh is a part of Azerbaijan, that Armenia is an uninjured party, but they can raise that issue, which would suggest that any state could raise this issue with any other state before the ICJ. But is there a legal recognition that Armenia, though maybe not a directly injured party, is advocating for the rights of Armenia? So when you talk about the Armeniophobia here, Armenia may not be immediately an injured party, but certainly a potentially injured party because of Armeniophobia. I guess to simplify the question, is Armenia really an uninjured party here? Or how much does the connection between Armenia and Armenians play a role in the way the issue gets framed legally?
Well, legally, Armenia raised the claim as the both an injured party and a non-injured party, just to cover both grounds. And of course, the refugee outflow into Armenian territory, the constant connections, the family connections, there's some the economic ties, the historical ties. I think there are strong, strong arguments to say that Armenia is an injured party, but it's also additionally an injured party. I think the interrelationship between the conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh, and then I think probably Richard can break this out even better, is the incursions and the invasions into the territory of Armenia proper, which have occurred since 2020 and go on, and the escalations of the violation of sovereignty of Armenia proper, which is connected to this and seems to be happening and is related to this vision of the Zangezur corridor that President Aliyev, in his maximalist language, uses. So there's a lot of bases on which Armenia is an injured party. But yes, when we talk about the right to non-discrimination, or when we're speaking about Armenophobia as a policy, that is an international, that's a universal obligation that any state could raise. The issue of the discrimination of an entire ethnic group of a people on the basis of their ethnicity, their religion, their identity, that is a jus cogens, we would say. It's a universal, it's an international norm that any state could raise.
And Richard, since Steve raised this question, very important one, the reports that I've seen in the region, they suggest that there have been violations of Armenia's sovereignty. There have been attacks. Could you give us some details about, have there been numerous ones, and what are the nature of some of these attacks?
Well, what we see is a serious attack back in September 2022. This was very unusual because that attack by the Azerbaijani armed forces against Armenia proper represented a significant expansion of the battle space, an escalation of the conflict in terms of an attack on Armenia that had nothing to do with Nagorno-Karabakh, yet everything to do with Nagorno-Karabakh. What Azerbaijan was trying to do here, I think, was a misread and a miscalculation. They have successfully relied on threats, use of force, aggression, and attacks in order to strengthen their diplomatic bargaining position with Armenia. The attack and incursion into Armenian territory, however, not only triggered a degree of diplomatic isolation for Azerbaijan, but posed a new interstate bilateral conflict that garnered the attention of the United States and the European Union in particular. What we see now is the subsequent deployment of several hundred EU monitors to Armenia, and specifically to the vulnerable areas of southern Armenia. In this context, they are our hostages or prisoners to our security, fortunately, and they're unarmed. And they're the only deterrent on the ground. The second aspect here is following the military incursion by Azerbaijan, their troops have not yet left Armenian territory. And this is not only a flagrant, egregious violation of international law and standards, it's technically an act of war. And I am surprised, however, that the Armenian government does not demand their full and complete withdrawal from Armenian territory as a prerequisite to the return to diplomacy. Armenia, interestingly, is returning to diplomacy without necessarily demanding or waiting for the withdrawal of the Azerbaijanis, which also means the international community should become much more active in pushing back and pushing out the Azerbaijani military formations that are still in Armenia. This is also important because there is no record whatsoever of Azerbaijani territorial claims against Armenia proper. This is also important in removing any kind of pretext for their presence.
And so Steve, Richard raised the issue about international actors. You had highlighted, you know, monitors, but also the ICJ ruling was an international action. Has the ICJ ruling changed, particularly from an international institutional perspective, the way that actors have viewed this conflict, or has it largely been a publicizing, this is going on? And so, I mean, it's at least in the news sources, but has there been any sort of formal reaction from institutions like potentially within the UN system?
Well, it does a number of things. I mean, first of all, it makes it much harder for Azerbaijan a year from now, let's say. It's now been ordered that Azerbaijan lift the blockade, allow free and unfettered access for aid. And if it does not do so, I think Armenia will have a much stronger case in a year's time. This just, you know, narrows the, just as I think Richard was saying that Azerbaijan lost some credibility or legitimacy by taking its actions against Armenia's sovereignty, this decision also hems in Azerbaijan's maneuvers. It's a very important legal precedent. But yes, I think your question implies correctly that it doesn't change the facts on the ground immediately. Certainly, we have much more high-profile decisions like the advisory opinion on Palestine that the International Court of Justice issued that also does not change those facts. But what it does is incrementally, it leads to more of a legal consensus, which of course interrelates with the political and diplomatic efforts to lend more legitimacy and supports, I think, also the organs of civil society and self-government in Nagorno-Karabakh. And I think, as I think about this conflict, and I know we're going to get to Ukraine later, but I think that as this evolves, what's so interesting is that this is a case study in how small states like Armenia, they may not be able to immediately change the facts on the ground with these sorts of decisions, but by playing this game of international legal chess, I think they do, again, gain credibility, legitimacy, political goodwill. We see that Armenia is also at the same time litigating in the European Court of Human Rights, Azerbaijan and Armenia both, talking about, again, the conduct of the 2020 war, war crimes violations, the use of cluster munitions and other banned weapons, prisoners of war, which continue to be held in Azerbaijani territory. Of course, Azerbaijan doesn't think of them as prisoners of war. But all these legal battles that are playing out, I think, are very important, and they influence the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearings that we've seen. Senator Menendez uses that precedent when he questions the State Department officials about, and increasingly, I think this what this all sort of adds up to for me is not just that Azerbaijan is violating human rights systematically and engaging in really, there's, you know, bad faith tactics, but that also that increasingly, I think we have to see this as a democracy pitted against a dictatorship, and that even Nagorno-Karabakh and its self-governing institutions, its human rights ombudsman, those bodies are acting democratically and they are acting legally and they're appealing to legal institutions. So it's an appeal to the rule of law, which I think increases this focus on Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh as democracies that are engaging with a dictatorship in this conflict.
And I think that's going to serve as a wonderful transition. And so we will take a break. We've been discussing the ongoing humanitarian crisis with the closing of the Lakhan Corridor that supplies Armenians living in Nagorno-Karabakh, Artsakh, you know, with supplies from Armenia at the hands of the Azerbaijanis. And we focus largely on the conflict as a local issue. When we return, we're going to internationalize and talk about some of the interests of actors within the region, including Russia, Turkey, the US, and potentially the EU. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're discussing the humanitarian crisis, the implications of Azerbaijan's blockade of the Nagorno-Karabakh region by closing the so-called Lachin Corridor that Armenia uses to supply Armenians living in the Azerbaijani territory of Nagorno-Karabakh, a move that took place back in December of last year and continues and is ongoing. Our panelists today are Richard Garagosian. He is the founding director of the Regional Studies Center, an independent think tank based in Yerevan, Armenia, and joins us from Yerevan. And Steve Swordlow. He is an associate professor of the practice of human rights in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Southern California. Now, Richard, you told me you just got back from Turkey. And so makes this a particularly fitting question that Azerbaijan is clearly definitely allied with Turkey. Turkey's, you know, provided resources, provided military training, et cetera. Is it fair to say that Turkey's interests are pretty synonymous with Azerbaijan, or what actually are Turkey's interests in this region?
Well, very good question. I was recently visiting the Turkish capital, Ankara, as well as Istanbul, in a visit that was timed with so-called earthquake diplomacy, and specifically looking at the outlook for the normalization of relations with Armenia and Azerbaijan. An earlier attempt that we call football diplomacy, involving soccer matches back in 2009 between Armenia and Turkey, that earlier round of negotiations, of engagement between Turkey and Armenia, was actually derailed, sabotaged by Azerbaijan. And at the time, Turkey rather timidly accepted Azerbaijan's protests and unfortunately missed an opportunity. This time around, we do see Azerbaijan much more self-confident, much more willing to see if normalization can proceed and move forward. But it does reveal an interesting power dynamic where the little brother of the relationship, Azerbaijan, has near veto power or control over bigger Turkey's policy options in the South Caucasus region. From an Armenian perspective, we always exploit that, because the Turkish state is deeply frustrated, not with Azerbaijan as a partner, but frustrated with Azerbaijan calling the shots regarding Turkish policy options. And I do think there is an increasing divergence of interests between Turkey and Azerbaijan. But Azerbaijan has significant economic weight in Turkey. It's the number one foreign direct investor in Turkey. And unfortunately, there is a distortion of the relationship in terms of one nation, two states concept. Having said that, it reveals a deeper problem that Steve has alluded to. Democracy under threat by larger authoritarian countries. The war of 2020 saw unprecedented direct military support from Turkey to Azerbaijan. In other words, Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh, both in terms of infant democracies, building democratic institutions, came under attack and under threat by two larger authoritarian countries, Turkey and Azerbaijan, in a war that was stopped by a third authoritarian country, the Russian Federation. This is a dangerous precedent, in my opinion, for the West, both for the United States and especially for European values. Because if left unchallenged, this distressing precedent tends to validate the use of force over the rule of law or diplomacy. It also vindicates authoritarian regimes over struggling democracies. So I do think this is the proper context when looking at the geopolitical balancing here. But I think what's much more of a driver is Russia, in terms of Russia being consistently and continually overwhelmed and distracted by its failed invasion of Ukraine.
That serves as a great transition. Steve, I'll bring you in now. In the Caucasus region, like in many places in the so-called post-Soviet space, Russia's made itself the invaluable partner, blocking any other external actors from serving a peacekeeping role while asserting that themselves. But definitely, at a minimum, Russia's distracted from the Caucasus because of the invasion of Ukraine, and certainly, perhaps even more so, the legitimacy of Russia as a peacekeeper can be called into question because of that foreign policy. So ultimately, can we chalk up, you know, this issue, this the closing of this corridor, at least in part, caused by Russia's invasion of Ukraine and their distractions and lack of legitimacy in the region?
Well, I think first and foremost, the responsibility is in the mind of one person, Aliyev, this maximalist idea that keeps getting bigger and bigger with claims to everything Armenian in the region. And of course, this the context of the war. First of all, we start with Azerbaijan. There's no other way to describe it, but Europe is simply falling at the feet of Baku. And, you know, this is a pattern that we've seen repeated now since the early 90s, where oil executives first and then diplomats later were fawning or were foaming at the mouth at the prospect of oil and what they could gain from the Caspian and work with this dictatorship. That has been renewed, unfortunately, again, given another lease on life by the war in Ukraine and the need to circumvent and supplement the oil routes that have been cut off because of sanctions and because of Russia's behavior. And so therefore, the EU has, the high-level politicians in the EU have really embarrassed themselves in the way they have described Aliyev as a close partner at the same time as he engages in this behavior. So I think, first of all, yes, that general geopolitical context has enabled Azerbaijan's actions. But is it that the war was the proximate cause? Again, I don't think so. I think it's certainly Russia's very problematic and complicated relationship has always been on display from the very beginning. They've been playing both sides, enabling the worst tendencies in both governments. I think, as Richard laid out, the change in 2018 and the move towards more democracy in Armenia certainly also has pushed the relationship, I think, happily into more clarity that Russia and Armenia don't really belong in some sense together politically, because one is a democracy and the other is a dictatorship. And that 2018 divide was also very important. But I do think that Russia's invasion of Ukraine and its blatant violation of international norms, it's an act of aggression. It becomes, it's interesting how for I guess for folks like me, human rights observers, I see the parallels with Azerbaijan so clearly. And yet geopolitically, diplomatically, as probably Richard can describe better than I can, there's this chess game that's so complicated where Ukraine and Azerbaijan have also at times exchanged friendly statements about territorial integrity, right? About the idea that Russia's claims to East Ukraine or Crimea should be rejected. And there's been common language there or common cause with Baku. Of course, Zelensky is doing what he needs to do, which is shore up support from wherever he can get it. But I think naturally, of course, the democratic partners here are Armenia and Ukraine. So the context is very complicated. But what we are seeing, again, with what's happening in Georgia, which is for another podcast, where they are copying some Russian legislation now on foreign agents laws, we see Russia's influence in the South Caucasus repeatedly and continuously being malign, being anti-human rights, being antithetical to actual true sovereignty on the part of these nations. So I don't know if I've answered your question, Doug, but I tried.
No, you have. But what's interesting is you're highlighting potential alliances on the basis of domestic government structures, more democratic governments, perhaps should be more aligned with more democratic governments against more authoritarian, you know, dictatorship. And to be clear here, for listeners, Aliyev, the Azerbaijani leader, it's uncontroversial to describe him as an authoritarian, as a dictator, and undemocratic with that. But Richard, what complicates all of this is the historical patterns, correct? That Russia has historically been seen by Armenians as the protector of Armenians. And this certainly dates back to even Armenia's decision to join the USSR out of fears of Turkey, you know, in that period. So historically, this has to be complicated for Armenians because Ukraine is the fellow democracy. They should side with Ukraine. But Armenia's relationship with Russia has typically, until recently, been very warm, and Armenians viewed the Russians as their protectors. So how do you navigate that?
Well, I would say one significant thing has changed in Armenia regarding Russia. The word is everything. In other words, Russia in Armenia has been exposed as a dangerously unreliable so-called partner. What's interesting is this has triggered a new trend in Armenian society that I've never seen before, that even among those pro-Russian Armenians, there's a divergence and a difference between still being pro-Russian and being pro-Kremlin or pro-Putin. And there is no longer any realistic expectation that Russia and the Russian leadership will fulfill its treaty obligations, its security expectations. Rather, Armenia is already looking, for example, elsewhere. Armenia has engaged in one defensive arms procurement deal since the war of 2020, and it's been with India. They've been looking to China for security. In other words, we're seeking greater balance. Our strategy regarding Ukraine is actually to do as little as possible and to say even less. Our voting record in the international community and organizations is often marked by being stuck in Manhattan traffic for the UN or being in the men's or women's room when the vote is being carried out. Abstentions have become a new diplomatic tool in our toolbox. And I think there's a belated, realistic adjustment and adaptation to the post-war reality where Russia is no longer the big brother to be counted on. But I think this is healthy. I think it's constructive. At the same time, what we're trying to do now is to resist the pull of the Russian gravitational orbit. In other words, to defend sovereignty and independence after years of mortgaging statehood to Russia. My question analytically is whether it's too little too late, given Russia's structural leverage. We have a Russian military base still in Armenia, the only one in the region besides the peacekeepers. Russia has complete control over two of Armenia's four external borders. In other words, the real challenge is a Sisyphus struggle in terms of overcoming years of mortgaged statehood. But I'm optimistic, largely because Armenia is endowed with a rare commodity of legitimacy and stability after two back-to-back free and fair elections. We've become too valuable to Putin in the future. And finally, there's a storm on the horizon that's coming, where no matter what happens in Ukraine on the ground, we all are going to face an angry, vengeful Russia, intent on revenge against all of its neighbors, from Moldova to Central Asia. This is the storm we're battering down our hatches for.
Oh, absolutely. And we're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the ongoing humanitarian crisis and political, legal, military implications in the Nagorno-Karabakh or Artsakh region between Armenia and Azerbaijan with Richard Garagosian of the Regional Studies Center in Yerevan, Armenia, and Steve Swerdlow of the University of Southern California. Now, Steve, if the Russians' position is at least potentially being challenged, I think it's fair to say, at a minimum, the legitimacy question, the distraction question, means that Russia's just not as engaged as it potentially could be. And the obvious answer there is, if there's a vacuum, who steps in? And so to talk about potential ones, the obvious one, especially with respect to Armenia, is the United States. You have a large Armenian expat community in the U.S. You've got Americans who, this is an issue that certainly is driving some representatives in Congress. But the U.S. has typically not really played all that significant of a role on the ground. Could that change, or is the U.S. more likely to continue this restraint in the region?
Well, this is a really important development. I was hoping this would come up, which is the former Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi's visit, historic visit, highest level U.S. official visiting Armenia in 30 years when she spoke out in September 2022. And she was addressing Azerbaijan's incursion into Armenia's borders by saying that this was illegal and this was deadly and that Azerbaijan's actions were jeopardizing any prospects for peace. I just thought that that trip, and of course, coming in the context of her also going to Taiwan and her general stance, I think, which became more muscular at the end of her term, to support democracies and to frame this in terms of democracies versus dictatorships, I thought that was extremely important. I hope what it does is herald a new chapter in U.S.-Armenia relations and partnership. There's another thing about the U.S. about the conversation of supporting democracies that the Ukraine war has brought up for me. Again, as a human rights person, I'm not usually in the position of saying that we need to arm countries. But I'm taking my cues from a guest you had on a previous show, a Ukrainian now Nobel Peace Prize winning activist, Oleksandr Matvichuk, who heads the Center for Civic Liberties, who when speaking about Ukraine and them being bombarded daily by Russian attack, said, you know, yes, we want your support for international accountability and human rights, but we need to live. We need to defend ourselves. And I think that conversation, to me, that is part of what's coming into focus here, is that when confronted by systematic violations and war crimes, even crimes against humanity, and we haven't really gotten into just the brutality of some of the 2020 war, the videos of beheadings, the use of sexual and gender-based violence, what I think that leads us to ultimately, and when we add that to what Richard just said about this rare commodity of democratic legitimacy, I think we will be at a point, I hope the United States is leading this conversation, where we say we must defend in a existential, physical, even military aspect, Armenia and its right to exist, which I think naturally extends to the Armenian inhabitants of Nagorno-Karabakh. Of course, we never want to forget or foreclose any conversations about the human rights of the Azerbaijani population that was forced to flee. That's part of the conversation, absolutely. But I just want to throw in this notion that the United States, I think, will increasingly, as we go forward, if we have a democratic administration, at least, I think we'll place an emphasis on supporting Armenia's democracy, its right to exist, its right to survive, in this context of, as Richard, I think, correctly and unfortunately said, Russia's revanchism, and its desire to continue expanding. If it can't do so in Ukraine, it may just do so more robustly in the South Caucasus. So we need to be ready for that.
Yes, and of course, you know, President Biden has declared a concern for democratic backsliding as perhaps the greatest security risk. And it's fair to say that waging war, violence against Armenia could certainly result in democratic backsliding. But at least this question about defending democracy against an undemocratic actor. So, Richard, the U.S. hasn't played this role, but you highlighted that Armenia's arms deal, that had this arms deal with India. Any possibility that the role the U.S. could potentially play could be in weapons and training of the Armenian military? Because in 2020, one of the observations that became very clear is that Armenians just were not well-armed, and the Azerbaijanis had gotten some really modern training, and that there was a lot of conversation that I understood out of Armenia that said, we're going to need to arm and we're going to need to train, because if we learned anything from the 2020 war is we were not prepared. So is the U.S. potentially going to play that role? And if not the U.S., who could potentially play the role?
Well, I have to be honest in terms of skepticism. I do think in terms of the U.S. national interest, there's little likelihood of the U.S. playing a military security provider role with Armenia. From an Armenian perspective, we don't want that, for the simple reason that we don't want to become a new arena of confrontation between Russia and the U.S. or French or the EU in terms of hard security. But realistically, what we do look for from Washington is their new policy of limited engagement based on I would say a modification of, say, the Bush administration's democracy promotion and a more realistic policy now of democracy protection, not promotion. This is where we need to invest in the institutionalization of democratic institutions with American Western support. I would say, however, that it's the European Union who can play more of a less provocative role, regional trade and transport, as well as their slogan, connectivity. The presence of the European monitors, for example, was amazingly a rapid decision and a very quick deployment. I've never seen the European Union move so quickly. Moreover, the European Union, for the first time in my lifetime, its actions on the ground match the slogans and ambitions coming out of Brussels here in Armenia. This is also crucial. But I do think EU engagement is much more acceptable to the presence and reality of Russia. And frankly, from a military perspective, I'm a former lecturer at Fort Bragg for the US Army Special Forces. Based on my experience, the Armenian Armed Forces has always been reliant on Soviet and then Russian weapons. There's enormous training that would be required for Armenia-US military connections. Having said that, from battlefield medicine to military education, the US can be, and already is, a niche provider for Armenia. Azerbaijan doesn't need the US or want the US because it has NATO member Turkey. And unfortunately, Turkey is much less a member of NATO and much friendlier lately to both Moscow and, unfortunately, Baku. So I don't have an answer to your question about where to look for security, but I do think we cannot we should not try to match Azerbaijan pound for pound in a race to the bottom. Rather, it's diplomacy over force of arms. That's the key.
And Steve, you had a potential answer to this question.
Just wanted to add one other aspect of this. And I think it's absolutely true. And I go back to my earlier point about small states like Armenia using international law to resolve disputes peacefully. I think that has been, again, inspiring that Armenia continues to chart that path. And so I think Richard's right on that point about not matching Azerbaijan's military might pound for pound, although the right to exist, you know, obviously requires self-defense. But I think I just wanted to also mention in response to your question that we haven't touched on the Collective Security Treaty Organization in the larger neighborhood of post-Soviet Eurasia. I follow Central Asia. And when Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan erupted into, had a war in 2022 and earlier in 2021, Russia's sort of impotence, inaction, a tradition of playing both sides, however you want to interpret its actions, was on full display. They did not intervene. They did nothing to prevent the deaths and the ethnic conflict occurring in the border regions between Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. Notably, the CSDO did deploy troops to Kazakhstan to prop up the president, Tokayev, reportedly at his request, which occurred just before the Russian invasion in January 2022. So it's a selective intervention by Russia, but notably Russia's slow response to the 2020 war and its overall inaction is something that Pashinyan called out when he refused to sign this draft declaration or agreement on the CSDO. So a lot of people have used that example to point to Russia's weakening overall power. I think that may oversimplify things, but the CSTO as an organization, as a peacemaker, certainly it's never been one, but now these recent events only highlight Russia's inability to guarantee security.
Unfortunately, we are out of time, but a quick reminder that back in 2020, when we discussed this issue for the first time, I remember considering that the ceasefire in particular, if there was one thing that we all felt fairly confident in predicting is that this war was not over with respect to the ceasefire. And unfortunately, I think the closing of the corridor and the current humanitarian crisis has bore that prediction out. And I'm comfortable making a prediction, uncomfortable with what the prediction actually is, but comfortable making the prediction that this war is still not over and will continue in these different forms, in these different manifestations. But what's particularly fascinating to me, it's pretty clear that the role Russia has traditionally played is changing as a result of their invasion of Ukraine. What eventually emerges is something that I was like in my classroom to teach these as ongoing political dramas that we need to pay attention to and to constantly update ourselves. And so with that, I think it's fair to say the one thing we all agree upon is that there needs to be actions taken to relieve the humanitarian crisis of the people and the threats of the people living in the Nagorno-Karabakh, the Artsakh region, because what could potentially happen could be absolutely devastating. Our guests today have been Steve Swerdlo, Associate Professor of the Practice of Human Rights in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Southern California. He's the author of Uzbekistan's Religious and Political Prisoners and Uzbekistan's Ethnic Minorities Out of Sight, but Not Out of Mind, and has extensively also researched the South Caucasus region. And Richard Garagosian, the founding director of the Regional Studies Center, an independent think tank located in Yerevan, Armenia. He's joined us from Yerevan today. He is also the visiting professor at the College of Europe's Natalin campus and senior expert at Yerevan State University's Center for European Studies. And he's the author of Small States and Large Costs of Regional Fracture, The Case of Armenia. Thank you both very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Special thanks to the Scholar Circle team, Maria Armudian, host and anchor, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongri, webmaster and production assistant, and Mahika Chechi is our intern. All Scholar Circle shows are archived on scholarcircle.org. You can find our podcast on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle Twitter account, and please join our Facebook page. On behalf of the Scholar Circle team, I am Doug Becker. Thank you for listening.